Hi, I'm David Fettes, and the aim of this talk is to help you to think humbler. Now, for those of you who are grammar police, I know that it should say think more humbly, but think humbler is shorter and easier to remember. So the goal by the end of this is to be able to think humbler. I'm going to be drawing again on two books that are very helpful in this regard, a scholarly book by Daniel Kahneman, a longer and more in-depth book. He's a professor at Princeton and a winner of the Nobel Prize. And then The Art of Thinking Clearly is a book by Rolf de Belli. We need to keep in mind that Kahneman talks about two systems, System 1 and System 2, the quick thinking and then the slow thinking. And our slower and more careful thinking System 2 is supposed to be very evaluative and rational, but often it's kind of a smug slug. It thinks very highly of itself, and it's kind of lazy. System 2 feels in charge, but it's lazy, and it prefers minimum effort. Some thoughts and actions that System 2 believes it rationally chose are prompted by System 1. You think you've really thought things through, when in fact all of that thinking through was just processing information that came from your almost automatic reflexes and your intuitions and your feelings, and your reason just found excuses to justify what you already received from your intuition. Quick, easy answers feel right, and you feel like you're very knowledgeable. You feel like you're very good at things. You feel like most of what you attempt is going to succeed. But is that really so? 84% of French men think they are above average lovers. Now, if it were true to what they really are, only 50% could be above average, but evidently 84% think they're in that upper 50%. 93% of American students think that they are above average drivers. Only 7% are below average in their own humble opinion. So, most people are better than average lovers, way more than half of people, almost 100% of people think they're above average drivers. We're better than average lovers. We're better than average drivers. And we are better than average thinkers. Most people assume we know more than we really do. We are more sure than the evidence would warrant. The Bible says the way of a fool seems right in his own eyes. The simple believes anything. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There is more hope for a fool than for him. Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool. Well, that's not very complimentary of being overconfident and thinking that you have a tremendous mind that always thinks accurately, logically, and truthfully. You're a lot better off saying, I'm wrong a lot. And I want to help you by knowing some of the ways that we tend to go wrong in thinking too highly of our own thinking. One of the most common is confirmation bias. That's the tendency to interpret new evidence to fit our prior beliefs and preferences and expectations. And confirmation bias filters out what doesn't fit by ignoring it. Or if we are aware of something that doesn't fit our conception of things, we call it an exception. Overall, I'm right, but there are exceptions here and there. Confirmation bias figures into our choice of what news channels we're going to pay attention to. We pay attention most of the time to news channels that tend to agree with the perspective we take, whether it's more conservative, whether it's more liberal, and so on. We like on social media to hang out with friends who think quite a bit the way we do, and we kind of avoid those who are on a different wavelength. We seek them out, and that in turn feeds into confirmation bias because we're kind of already hearing what we want to hear, and it reinforces us even more that that's the way right-thinking people really think. Confirmation bias has an impact in a whole bunch of different areas. Your own self-image is reinforced again and again by various circumstances. If you already feel bad about yourself, then every bad thing that happens to you just piles on and reinforces that you're a loser. If you feel really great about yourself, then everything that comes your way that makes you feel even greater puffs you up. In the world of astrology, you get horoscopes that tell you things about yourself. You say, you know, that sounds about right. It's amazing what those horoscopes can tell a person. But of course, they're often so general that what's already in your own thinking about yourself just latches onto a word here or there in the horoscope and just confirms what you already believe about yourself. In the world of business, you want to follow a certain strategy. And if it goes well, you say, boy, things are going well because of my excellent strategy. If they aren't going well, you say, well, my excellent strategy hasn't quite had time to kick in yet. In the world of medicine, doctors are very confident sometimes of their diagnoses. In one study of people who had died, there was a comparison of the diagnosis by the physician and then what the autopsy actually showed as the cause of death. The physicians had a very high degree of certainty that they were correct, and so the study took the cases of which they had a very high degree of certainty and confidence and found that they were wrong 40% of the time. A little scary next time you go to the doctor. Science has a tendency to confirm its existing theories and to ignore inconvenient data. If things don't fit Darwinian evolution, well, we'll believe Darwinian evolution anyway. And it's been that way in the past with other scientific views. When the Earth was considered to be the center of the universe, it was very hard for any inconvenient data that didn't quite fit that, and much data did seem to fit it if you worked at it hard enough, but there was always a few inconvenient facts that didn't fit. Science looks for ways to confirm its existing theories, and that's not a flaw of science, that's just a feature of human nature, that we tend to look for things that confirm the way we already think about them. Politics, do I need to say that people who take a political position, it's almost impossible to persuade them otherwise because everything that happens confirms their political conviction. And in theology too. When you go to the Bible, everything you look confirms your belief about infant baptism or confirms your belief that infant baptism is wrong. It confirms your belief that free will decides everything about the matter of salvation, or it confirms your belief that God predestines and controls everything that happens. And you read the Bible with an eye toward what agrees with you, and anything that wouldn't be quite so convenient for my particular theological system, you just kind of fudge there. So confirmation bias has influence in a lot of different areas. One scholar says to the other, did you read my paper on confirmation bias? Yes. But it only proved what I already knew. What the human being is best at doing is interpreting all new information so that their prior conclusions remain intact. That's what the famed investor Warren Buffett said. If you want to battle confirmation bias, at least a little, you'll never escape it completely. But to try to battle it and counteract it, seek evidence against your belief. Look for things that don't fit what you think. Listen to views that are different from yours. Really listen. And try to find out if there's things somebody else is seeing that you're not. Closely related is self-serving bias, where we are biased in favor of ourselves. My success is from my skill, my intelligence, my hard work. My failure, that's due to other factors. Spouses feel that they've done more than their share. The husband feels he's doing more than his fair share in the marriage and his wife isn't quite doing as much as she ought to. But the wife knows she's doing more than she ought to be doing really, and the husband isn't carrying his share of the load. Or if you're in the business environment, this member of the team is certain that he's working harder and making a bigger contribution to the project than those other slackers that he has to work with. Rolf de Belli once asked five roommates in a building where he lived to explain how often they took out the garbage. He asked each one separately while he was riding down elevator at different times with them, just as kind of a little experiment. He took the answers they gave, and it added up to 320%. They were taking out the garbage 320% of the time total. So somebody was overestimating their contribution. Now, part of this is related to what the psychologists call availability bias. What comes to mind first and what's on our radar. And we notice what we do. We don't notice what other people do nearly so much. And so we tend to overestimate our overall contribution, whether we're rooming with people, whether we're part of a marriage, whether we're working as part of a business team, whether we're working as part of a church team. We notice what we're doing. We're less good at noticing what others do. And we need to think humbler and realize that the self-serving bias is very, very strong. Another bias is introspection bias, thinking that if only you do more soul-searching, more looking inside, then you'll get reliable knowledge, knowledge of yourself, knowledge of what you ought to do. And certainly sometimes it does help to do some soul-searching and looking inside, but the trouble with that is you're always still just looking inside at you and using your own mind to think about you. Introspection is biased in favor of yourself, and it's biased in favor of your current beliefs and behavior. Introspection ignores input from outside, and it tends to discount critics. And so we need to, as the Bible says, be open to rebuke, be open to the wisdom of a multitude of counselors, and not just say, wow, I really need to go deep inside and figure out what I need to do next and how I can be more sensible. Introspection bias is best counteracted by seeking input and really listening to the input of others. False consensus bias is assuming that just about everybody, or at least most people, and certainly most right-thinking people, would agree with me. A psychologist ran an experiment, and he asked a variety of students, a lot of them, if they would wear a sign for a half hour, a sandwich board, "Eat at Joe's." Just walk around on the sidewalk and wear that sign. They were asked, "Will you wear it?" And then they were also asked, "Do you think others would wear it?" And 62% of those who said they would wear it were then asked, "Well, would others do it too?" And they said, "Yeah, they would. You know, it's just kind of funny. It's something to do. Other people would do that too." And those who refused to wear the sign, when they were asked, "Well, do you think others would also refuse?" "Yeah, of course they'd refuse to do something so dumb." So you see that in both cases, a very strong majority assumed that others who did it, others would want to do what they chose to do. Surely others agree with you, and if not, there's something a little wrong with them. It's again that kind of self-centered thing where you project your own thinking, your own attitudes onto others and think, yeah, they're pretty much like me. And if you're aware of this bias, of this false consensus, assuming that the rest of the group thinks like you do, it'll help you. Preachers, don't assume that everybody in your group is in agreement with you just because they don't raise their hand or yell or say, "Preacher, I disagree." If you're a pastor and you're counseling with somebody, and they just look at you and look kind of polite and nod their head a little bit, don't assume that they think, "Wow, that pastor is giving me brilliant advice. I am going to go do it right away." You can't assume false consensus. You kind of have to keep on watching, keep on listening to see whether people really agree with you and be open to the possibility that they don't agree with you. And sometimes you can send a signal that you really don't want to hear from people who would disagree. You want the assumption that everybody agrees with you, and then sometimes you'll get what you want, not in the sense that they agree with you, but in the sense that they'll never communicate disagreement. They'll let your bias stay firmly in place. Attention bias is another thing where we need to learn to think a little more humbly, because sometimes when we're paying very close attention to one thing, the thing we think matters most, we miss something else entirely. There's a famous experiment in psychology where various subjects in the experiment were asked to watch a video. And in this video, they were asked to watch some people passing a basketball back and forth and weaving in and out among each other. And there were several people wearing white and several wearing black. And the subjects were asked, "Now, count the number of passes that are made by the team wearing white." And so they watch very carefully. And because the various players wearing white and black were weaving in and out from each other and passing and sometimes doing tricky passes, it was not easy to follow. So they would watch, and then at the end of the video, they finally had the count. And they were asked, now, how many passes were there? And they wrote down the number of passes. Then they were asked kind of a strange question. Did you see the gorilla? Gorilla? What gorilla? In the middle of this video of the team wearing white and the team wearing black weaving in and out and passing a basketball, someone wearing a gorilla uniform walks in, stands in the middle of the whole thing for 9 seconds, pounds their chest, and then after 9 seconds in the middle of the video, leaves. And more than half of the people watching the video and counting the passes of the team wearing white didn't see the gorilla. And they would not believe the researcher when he said there had been a gorilla in the middle of that video until they rewatched it. Because, you see, when your attention is very focused and your mind is following something that's kind of hard to follow, it can shut out an awful lot of other details. We see what we focus on. As Daniel Kahneman says, we can be blind to the obvious and we can be blind to our blindness. We don't even know what we're blind to. Specialty bias is assuming that my specialty, the thing that I'm really good at, reveals the only cause of something, and I know the one solution, and it happens to lie within my specialty. If your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. That's the old saying. So we need to avoid the single cause fallacy, thinking that a set of events has a single, easily identified cause, and it just happens to be caused by the area that I'm good at figuring out, and that it can be solved by the one thing that I'm good at suggesting. We need to seek multiple causes and reasons why something might be happening, and we need to consider whether there might be a variety of responses that would address the whole situation. Otherwise, we get too focused in on what we happen to be good at. Often at times, it takes teamwork. People with a variety of skills and specialties, people who are good at a variety of things to achieve the overall result. And so, think humbler. Realize that the things that you might happen to be good at are only a small circle compared to the total truth that's out there and the total factors in a situation. And if you think humbler, then you're readier to see that other people have good insights and they might also have good skills that can do things that you can't. We're too sure of what we think we know, and we seldom realize the vastness of our ignorance and the uncertainty of our world. The vastness of our ignorance and the uncertainty of our world. We'd rather think that we just know it all. Survivor's bias is another difficulty. Survivor's bias is caused by the way people are brought to attention, say in the news or in other kinds of coverage. Lottery winners are on the news. They won the Mega Millions. They got so much money. Whoa, they won big. Professional athletes are on television and in the news all the time. Famous actors are on the screen of the TV and the movie theater, and you see these people who've made it big as actors and are getting paid millions and millions of dollars for every show. You see books by famous authors, and you think, I could be an author. You hear the famous singers and you listen to their albums and you watch their music videos and you wonder whether you might be able to be a great singer. You see the tremendous business entrepreneurs, the people who become billionaires, those who started their own businesses, and you say, I think maybe I ought to start a business. You see successful churches. They've become mega churches. They've grown huge. And you say, I bet if I planted a church, it might take off. But you don't think to yourself, most people who play the lottery lose money. Most people who try to be professional athletes don't. There's one in a million chances that I could ever be a professional athlete. Most people who try to be actors may act in their high school play, and they may get really poor in college while they major in drama, And then they try to get an acting job, but they just aren't out there, or they don't pay anything, so you get a second and third job. That's what happens to most people who go into acting. For every author who gets published, there are hundreds who don't. For every famous singer, there are hundreds of wannabes who maybe sang for a little group here or there in their own setting, or sang a bit of karaoke in a bar one time, but they sure never made it big. For everybody who launched a company or tried to, 2 out of 3 business starts fail. Much the same is true of church planting. It's not for the faint of heart. Most church plants don't last for very many years, and very few of them turn into megachurches. What a bunch of discouraging, downer information. But why don't you hear more about the vastly greater number who fail? Well, because of survivor's bias. The ones who make it big are the ones who also get all the publicity. But when you're thinking rationally, it's wise to pay some attention to those who didn't get all the publicity, because there are a lot more of them. But if you're blind to the probability of failure, then you overestimate your chances of success and you say, I could make it big as a singer. I could be a great athlete. Why, I made 10 free throws in a row one game. And you don't realize the level of skill that it takes to really be the super elite in any of these areas. That doesn't mean you should never try anything. We'll get to that a little bit later. But it does mean that if you try something, don't overestimate your chances of success just because you heard about the successes and haven't paid attention to the failures. Don't be taken in by survivor's bias. Outcome bias is evaluating a decision by how it turned out, by the results, not by whether it was based on the best information that was available at the time. And so sometimes you get reckless leaders who get lucky. They make a rash decision that had very little chance of succeeding, but they're one of the lucky ones, and it turned out. And now they're praised for being bold and for having foresight, and they're put in charge of many greater things, and many times they end up wrecking that enterprise. Sometimes wise leaders who end up with a bad result are blasted as incompetent, even though they made a good decision based on the best information and took the best approach at the time, but things just didn't work out because there's a lot that's beyond our control. But outcome bias just makes the decision about how good or bad it was based on how it turned out. We credit presidents with saving the economy when, in fact, sometimes it's just great inventions or other things in the business world that took off and had almost nothing to do with the president at the time. But hey, outcome bias, he must be good for the economy because the economy went well during the past 4 years. The Bible says not everything is under our control, and outcomes don't always reveal how fast or strong or smart you were. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant, but or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. In short, stuff happens. And sometimes good stuff happens, and not always because of your brilliance. Sometimes bad stuff happens, and not always because of your stupidity. But outcome bias tells us that if it turned out well, I was brilliant. If it turned out poorly, somebody was dumb. Hindsight bias is the sense that my mind has a firm grasp on what has happened and that my memories are accurate. The fact of the matter, as is demonstrated by a lot of research in cognitive psychology, is that your memories change to fit how things turned out or to fit your current opinions. A major project surveyed 3,000 people's views on a variety of issues and asked them how they thought things would turn out in the political realm and in some other things. Then they were interviewed again some years later, and it was found that their memories of what they had said back then matched their current views, not what they had said years ago. They didn't remember accurately what they had said. Their memories of what they said turned out to be exactly what they were thinking now, which was not the same as they were thinking back then. Even flashbulb memories are often very mistaken. What's a flashbulb memory? Well, it's one of those that's just imprinted on your mind, and it is so unforgettable and vivid and real, it's like you're still there. Sometimes it happens in connection with a great tragedy. Like, I knew exactly where I was when the airplanes hit the towers in 2001. Or I knew exactly where I was when some other great event happened. And I remember it like it was yesterday. Except you don't. Sorry. Most of the time, even your flashbulb vivid memories do not accurately capture how you really felt at the time. Again, psychologists have done research. For example, after the explosion of the Challenger space shuttle back in the 80s, a professor immediately got a lot of different students to write down where they were, how they felt, what they witnessed at the time. Then he went back to those same students 3 years later and asked them to record. And they all knew exactly how they felt back then. They all remember those memories were so vivid, except there wasn't a very close match between what they wrote down 3 years later and what they wrote a day later. One student was shown, he said, I know that's my handwriting, but I couldn't have written that. That's how even our flashbulb most vivid memories are. So, again, memory has value, but don't be so sure that your memory is right. Sometimes you get in an argument with somebody and you say, I remember exactly how it happened. Okay, two things to keep in mind. First thing, if you remember, you're remembering from your perspective what happened. And secondly, you know what? You might not even remember accurately what happened because memory is very, very tricky. And so when you're in a sharp disagreement with somebody else, it's not just pulling the trump card to say, but I remember. Because sometimes you don't. Memories change. Our minds have imperfect ability to reconstruct past states of knowledge or beliefs that have changed. Sometimes you think you believed something all along, but you actually changed your mind about it. Once you adopt a new view of the world or any part of it, you lose much of your ability to recall what you used to believe before your mind changed. I know people who, after they grew up, declared themselves to be transsexual, and they remember their childhood. Or do they? Because I remember sometimes people back in their childhood, and I remember some of the things they said and did, and it's really quite different than their memory. Now, maybe I'm wrong in what I remember, but maybe when you change your mind about who you are and who you've decided to become, your whole view of your childhood and how it developed has changed. The illusion that one has understood the past feeds the further illusion that one can predict and control the future, says Daniel Kahneman. That's the forecast illusion. Here's an annual survey. It asked chief financial officers of major corporations to estimate the S&P index returns for the next year. So the big financial markets, how are the stocks and other financial markets going to do in the next year? And this survey was taken year after year after year of the top chief financial officers of the big corporations. Then the researchers took 11,600 total forecasts and matched them up with how the S&P actually did a year later. They found that there was zero correlation. In fact, there was slightly less than zero, so even a negative correlation with the forecast and the actual value of the S&P. In other words, the expert forecasts were literally worthless, and they still didn't know it. They still thought that they had a pretty good idea of how the markets were going to do in the year to come. Not exactly, but a pretty good idea, when in fact they didn't know any more than anybody else how the markets were going to do. There are two kinds of forecasters: those who don't know and those who don't know they don't know. That's John Kenneth Galbraith. Economists think they can forecast what's going to happen with the economy, but most of the time they're forecasts are worth almost nothing. Studies of fund managers who try to manage and beat the returns of the market. Studies find again and again and again that just a market index beats 80% of the fund managers. Climate scientists forecast what's going to happen in 10 years, in 40 years, in 100 years? A quick question. In the past, how well have climate scientists predicted the future? Second question. Is climate so simple with so few factors that with enough study, scientists can figure it out and predict it? Don't think so. When it comes to tech futurists, what's going to be invented 10 years from now, 30 years from now? What's going to be the next big thing in 50 years? Books are written like that, but let me assure you, if you go back 50 years and read those books, they will read as a comedy. And then there are those who have forecast illusion about Jesus' return. They've studied the Bible carefully. They've looked at all the signs of the times. They've computed this. They've calculated the secret meaning of that. And now they know that Jesus is going to return at thus and such a time. There was only one verse they missed. Jesus' statement, "No one knows the day nor the hour, not even the Son of Man." When Jesus was on earth, even he didn't know. But somehow the date setters can forecast it. There are two kinds of forecasters, those who don't know, and those who don't know, they don't know, and they try to forecast. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we'll live and do this or that. So you can always forget God's role in it. And the fact is, when you're forecasting, oftentimes you forget not only God's appointment and God's direction of events, but you also just don't know how much you don't know. So forget the forecast illusion. Along with the forecast illusion comes our planning. And our planning is often very different from reality. The Scottish Parliament decided it needed a new building and it was going to build it. And the estimated cost of building it was $40 million. The final cost, or not dollars, 40 million pounds. And the final cost was 431 million pounds, 10 times the original estimate. You say, that's just one project that got way out of hand. Newsflash, most projects get way out of hand beyond the original estimate. Rail projects worldwide. This isn't just looking at one railroad here or there, but worldwide, a study of many, many rail projects found that the projects cost 45% more on average than was estimated originally. And also, estimates of passenger use were 106% greater than actual use. So, for any given railway project, it's going to cost almost half again as much as you think it's going to, and it's going to serve less than half as many passengers as you claim it's going to. But the next railway project will come along and the next state or city or country will hail it as the thing that's going to make a big difference and serve so many people and only cost this much. Plans have to take into account what the average is, what other similar projects have done before you say, and that's the way it's going to be. In 2002, Americans remodeling their kitchens had an expected cost of $18,658 and actual cost of $38,769. Probably be higher now, but the point is, it was more than double what they estimated when they decided first to start remodeling their kitchen. In planning bias, you expect things to go as planned. And in that expectation, you ignore your own track record. How often in your life do things always go the way you planned them? And you also are ignoring that there are just factors completely outside the plan and outside your track record and your control. And so it's a lot more humble and it's a lot more realistic to plan by considering other similar projects. If you are a railway planner, don't just look at your estimate of things or what you think will happen and how many people it will serve. Look at what's happened with similar rail projects all over the world and then try to adjust accordingly and say, it's going to cost more than I think. And it's not going to serve nearly as many people as I think. Now, is it still worth doing? Maybe so. But realize that planning has got to consider other similar projects. And another suggestion that has been made by people who are trying to help overcome planning bias is this. When you've got a plan, now take a moment. Take more than a moment. And imagine a year from now. Imagine that it has just turned out to be a disaster. Please describe how your plan turned out to be a disaster. Now, if you do that, then you start thinking of possibilities that could go wrong, and maybe after you've done that, you will have helped to prevent the disaster. But at any rate, if you never consider other projects that are similar, never imagine anything disastrous happening in your plan, then you're guilty of planning bias and you're headed for some trouble. Then another bias that, again, is kind of related is control bias. Planning bias comes because we think we can control things. Rolf Dobelli tells the story of a man who goes out into the town square every day wearing a red hat. And he takes off that hat and he waves it wildly for 5 minutes. And he waves it and he waves it, and then he puts it back on and walks away. He does that day after day after day. Goes into the town square, waves his hat for 5 minutes, then leaves. One day, somebody comes up to him and says, "Why are you doing that?" He says, "Well, I'm keeping the giraffes away." "Well, there aren't any giraffes here." "Well, I must be doing a good job." That's control bias, thinking that your actions are the decisive factor in the situation, thinking we can control things that we really can't control. You ever heard of placebo buttons? You may not have heard of them, but you might be using them. When you come to a traffic light and you're getting a little antsy and you want to walk across the traffic, you want to change that light and, whew, good, there's a button there. And you press that button. And once you press that button, then pretty quick, it'll give a red light to that traffic that's coming and you can get the walk signal and walk right across. Aren't you glad you have that button? Except in many cases, that's a placebo button. It does exactly nothing except make you feel like you're in control and not get quite so antsy and so restless while you wait for the traffic. It's deliberately put there for that purpose. Or you're on an elevator and it has door open button and door close button, and you joyously push the door open button so it'll hurry up and open and you can get off. And what do you know? It opens. Or you get into it and you push the door close button. Good, now it's closing and I can get going in this elevator. Many times, those are placebo buttons. They do exactly nothing. The elevator was going to close when it was set to close, no matter what button you pushed. And it was going to open no matter whether you pushed the open button or not. It was a placebo button to keep you from getting too restless on the elevator. But it's there to reinforce your control bias. You feel like you're in control, so you feel better about the situation. Well, sorry, next time you're going to be in the elevator at that traffic light, you might not have quite so much confidence in that handy little button. At any rate, control bias is there in doctors, assuming they can control more than they can. Economists thinking that by taking this or by raising interest rates, by dropping interest rates, by holding this policy, this is going to control the economy. Or by politicians who think, oh, there's a situation, we've got to do something, we've got to do it now. Doctors will say, oh, the person's sick, we've got to intubate now, we've got to prescribe this, we've got to do that surgery. Well, sometimes that's needed. Sometimes it would be wiser to just let the situation develop a little further and maybe resolve itself. Sometimes politicians do more harm than good by doing something rather than by doing nothing. But control bias makes us feel like we've got to do something and do it now. Doing nothing is just, oh, we can't stand that. Many an investor would be wise to take the advice of the famed investor Jack Bogle. He said, don't just do something, stand there. And the old saying is, don't just stand there, do something. But if you're an investor, a lot of the time, don't just do something, stand there. Leave it alone. Leave your investments alone, because a lot of the time, your attempt to control it just after the markets have gone down means you're going to lose a lot of money. So control bias can cost you, literally. Our comforting conviction that the world makes sense rests on a secure foundation, our almost unlimited ability to ignore our ignorance. Say, what a rude thing to say. Well, maybe so, but Daniel Kahneman is one of the foremost cognitive psychologists in the world, with vast knowledge of the field and with vast knowledge of how confident we are in what we think and how ignorant we really are. The Bible says, the man who thinks he knows something does not yet know as he ought to know, but the man who loves God is known by God. We rely so much on what we think we know, but it's actually God's knowledge of us and His work in our lives that makes a bigger difference. The Apostle Paul says, now I know in part, and only later will I know fully. And he says, now that you know God, or rather are known by God. So sometimes we ought to be very cautious in our claims about we know, and supremely in our claims of how much we know of God. You claim you know God, well, rather you're known by God, and you rest in that fact rather than in the quality of your own knowledge. So think humbler. You have many mental blind spots. You're wrong more than you admit. You understand less than you realize. Many of your plans and expectations fail. Much is beyond your control. And yet, does that mean, okay, there's no use thinking anymore because no matter how hard you think, you're wrong a lot of the time. There's no use trying anything anymore because the likelihood of failure is greater than the likelihood of success. Well, maybe so, but if you don't think at all and don't learn to think harder, then you're going to be wrong even more than you otherwise would be. And if you never take any risks, then you don't risk failure, you guarantee failure. You cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning and at evening, let not your hands be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. So you don't know. So if at first you don't succeed, try again. You don't understand everything, but try to understand what you can, and then humbly do your thinking, and humbly do your risking. Well, let's review a little of what we've learned about thinking fast and slow. System one, your intuition is fast, involuntary, it's automatic, it's effortless. And system two is slow, deliberate, it's attentive, it's effortful. I've been highlighting some of the glitches or things that go wrong in our thinking, but we can be very grateful for the minds that we have been given. And even though they're distorted by our own limits and sometimes by our own sin, it's great to have both of these, intuition and the ability to think more carefully and deliberately. There's complementary roles. System one, your automatic reaction, and system two, your attentive thinking, work well together much of the time. System one saves you time and energy, and pondering every belief and every decision would be too slow and exhausting, so system one takes care of a lot of that. And then system two can think more carefully and rationally and evaluate as needed. But beware of the biases. System one has built-in biases. It tends toward systemic, frequently repeated errors in certain types of situations that we've looked at. System two is sometimes blind to the biases of system one, and it accepts its errors rather than finding them and fixing them. And be aware of the tendency of system two to be a smug slug. System two feels like it's in charge, but it's lazy. It prefers the least effort possible. Some thoughts and actions that System 2 believes that it rationally chose are prompted by System 1. You think that you really thought this through, but all the time you were being led by your feelings, by your intuitions, by your likes, your dislikes, by your instantaneous reaction, and what your mind was really doing was just finding excuses to do what your intuition wanted to do anyway. The quick, easy answers that feel right aren't always right. So don't be a slug, think harder. Don't be smug, think humbler. If a belief or decision is minor, go with your intuition. Don't think too hard. If a belief or decision could have important long-term impact, then think harder and think humbler. And all along, train your thinking skills so that system two can work well when needed. And that's what logic and critical thinking are about, to help train your thinking skills. To get at truth, think harder, think humbler, and then strengthen your skills to see the structure of arguments, to see whether the argument is actually sound, whether it's actually valid, whether what's claimed as the conclusion is actually supported by the premises that are presented. Be better at detecting cognitive biases and fallacies. We're going to look at some more fallacies in later talks. Learn to use inductive logic. Learn to use some of the tools of probability, not just whether you feel like something is likely, but to actually look at the data and then be able to estimate more accurately how probable it really is, and be able to use deductive logic and proofs. These are some of the thinking skills that we can learn when we study logic and critical thinking. I hope that you'll be able to think harder, think humbler, think more accurately, realizing that we're never going to think perfectly, but we can certainly improve our thinking.